Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just coming up on 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juneau afternoon, and my guests will be talking about some of the aspects of UAS. In a moment or two, we'll be hearing from Jeremy Kane from the UAS Art Program. We'll also hear from the folks who are putting on a big St. Paddy's Day party at Rockwell. That's the band Fire on McGinnis. The folks who are doing tonight's Fireside Lecture will be dropping in. Roman Matika and Jason Amundsen, also from UAS, will be joining us to tell us about their glacier calving talk tonight. And our final guest this afternoon will be David Leggett, who's with Coastal Footprint. It's all here on Juneau Afternoon. Hey, look out the window. You see that stuff? The Weather Bureau says it's going to continue tonight. We're supposed to have diminishing snow through this evening, and they're saying we're going to get a total of somewhere between 2 and 4 more inches. Saturday will be mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers in the morning. Those scattered snow showers will turn to rain in the afternoon. The highs will be around 34, and Saturday night mostly cloudy, scattered snow showers again. There's a chance of snow on Sunday and a chance of no snow on Monday through Thursday. They're saying just partly cloudy for those days. So a little spring snowstorm here, a little variety in the weather. Gee, we never have that in Juneau, do we?
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Sandia Pueblo is one of the first tribes in the country to take advantage of provisions in the Hearth Act. Signed into law last year, it aims to jumpstart economic development and improve home ownership in Indian Country. As KUNM's Tristan Autone reports, tribal and federal officials met Thursday in New Mexico.
Under Hearth, tribes are able to approve land leases and develop leasing regulations for business, residential, or other purposes without having to seek permission from the federal government. Previously, the Bureau of Indian Affairs lease approval process could take anywhere between 6 months to 2 years. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says instead of Sandia Pueblo having to deal with the BIA, the Pueblo itself can now issue leases without federal oversight.
This important step today on the Hearth Act brings to closure a sad saga of the United States not trusting Indian Country. The President has been very clear that we have a nation-to-nation relationship.
Sandia Governor Victor Montoya says with the elimination of BIA red tape, Pueblo land development will go faster and negotiations with partnering companies will also become easier.
The southern border is what we're looking at for opportunities for economic development and now to diversify from gaming.
Montoya says Sandia Pueblo is looking to put in drainage systems with the help of outside contractors, further develop a local airport, and build a major retail center. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar on Thursday also finalized water rights settlements with 4 New Mexico tribes. Tribal, state, and federal officials met in Santa Fe. According to the Interior Department, the settlement provides mechanisms for managing water in the Pauque River Basin to satisfy the current and future water needs of the pueblos of Tesuque, Nambe, Pauque, and San Ildefonso. And it will also minimize disruptions to non-Indian water users. The chairman of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Ottawa Indians in Michigan signed a same-sex marriage bill today and is officiating a wedding of 2 men. According to the Associated Press, the tribal council approved the measure earlier this month. The state does not recognize same-sex marriage. Tribal college basketball teams from across the country are seeking top spots at the American Indian Higher Education Consortium's tournament this weekend. More than 30 teams, both men's and women's, are competing in Minnesota. J.P. Rehnquist from WGZS reports.
Greg Molly, head men's basketball coach from Northwest Indian College in Bellingham, Washington, traveled to Minnesota with his team hoping to defend their 2012 national title. Molly says that many of the student-athletes in the tournament have overcome difficult life circumstances to succeed at this level.
It's a problem in all of Indian Country. Poverty, joblessness, homelessness, that's everywhere. And we as an Indian nation have to come together and come up with solutions and help our people heal. Because really it's about healing and recovering before we can make that next step.
Jennifer Johnson is principal of Fond du Lac Ojibwe School, where some of the games are being played. She says that this tournament is a great opportunity for her kindergarten through 12th grade students to see what success looks like.
They're seeing people that look like them, and they're out there playing, they're going to school. Everything that we're telling our students that they can do, they're seeing that other people are doing it.
The tournament winners will be announced on Sunday. On Fond du Lac Reservation, I'm J.P. Rehnquist for National Native News.
During this month in 2009, the International Indian Treaty Council honored Carrie Dan and Manny Pino for their work to protect sacred sites. They were awarded during a Sacred Places Symposium in San Francisco, California. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes and about 9 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first guest today on Juneau Afternoon is Jeremy Kane, good friend from the University of Alaska. He's in charge of the art program up there and is about to undergo a major college experience in the life of a college professor. I hear you got sabbatical coming next year.
I do. I'm going to take a half a year off and finally get the chance to really focus specifically on my art, you know.
Yeah.
Should be great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful refreshment in the middle of an academic career. Yeah,
it's like being back in college again, trying to plan for an 8-month trip.
Yeah, what's your plan?
I'm going to start in Helena, Montana, and kind of revisit going back to the Archie Bray Foundation. I've been awarded a 1-month stay there, and I'll be out. I'll be able to stay at the actual foundation, and I'll be there for a month straight. So it'll be an amazing experience, be able to work with another 10 or 12 people I've never worked with before that are all at the professional level, often other faculty members and professors that have been, taking a sabbatical or else graduate students and things like that. So, you know, I'm going to do it during the winter time, so I have a little bit of a better focus sometimes in the summertime there. There's a lot of people, and you know, it's nice to talk about a lot of things, but it's also nice to get dirty, you know?
Yeah, and you can enjoy the wonderful Montana winter.
Right. Well, no place like home.
Yeah. It can really get cold with that wind blowing through eastern Montana. Like
yes.
Helena is one of the places like Great Falls. I spent some time there myself, and you can get bone cold in that country.
Sure.
Yeah. But not if you're sitting next to a pottery kiln.
That's
just
right.
Tending the fire. You got
only
a good
fire
good
and bricks.
So what's going on with the art program at UAS?
Right now we are getting ready to do a redesignation to the Sobeloff building, and we've been kind of preparing for our summer courses and just kind of taking materials underway and getting ready for a beginning and intermediate advanced firing methods course for ceramics.
Now, even though you're taking sabbatical, that doesn't happen until after summer, right?
Actually, the first of the year in January.
Oh, okay. So you're teaching courses.
Of course, yep.
Summer and fall.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And we'll be doing some raven's tail weaving and basketry and harvesting. There's a field sketching and nature drawing course, as well as a new class that's collage and papermaking, which should be an interesting class. And quite a variety of times when things are offered and throughout the summertime. So it should be a good summer on campus. It's really nice out there in the summertimes.
There's some easy way, I think, for people to find out when these classes are being offered like that, right?
Yes. In the weekly, there's a great summer schedule that's, you know, hard copy. And, of course, on UAS online, you can find the summer classes, you know, mm-hmm. even on your phone. Yeah, there's quite a bit going on out there.
Yeah, and there's also programs that particularly people who are over 65 need to check into, because sometimes the tuition can be waived.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
And,
so,
if a class doesn't completely fill with, college students per se, or your stereotypical college student, and then, you know, anybody over the age of 65 is welcome for sure.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun to have a little diversity in the classes, you know, so I would do it.
And can you, for folks that might not have gone around behind the Sobeloff building and found you down there, can you kind of describe your layout?
Sure. We have several wood-fired kilns based on a Japanese tradition and kind of We've got a salt-fired kiln and a wood, salt wood is what we call it, and it's a vegetable kiln. So that kiln's fired specifically with vegetable oil, and then in the tail end of it, we'd put soda or salt in it. Then we have a wood-fired kiln. It's a coffin kiln, and that's specifically fired with wood. We've got a couple gas kilns out there, along with a raku kiln and a pizza oven, which is kind of nice.
Wood-fired pizza oven. I've heard about this.
Yep. Strictly educational.
Yes, naturally, right. So, yeah. Are you crossed with the school downtown so that you're doing training for chefs?
That's right. That's right.
Anyway, come on now. Did you guys really build a pizza oven in the backyard?
Well, it's a different way of stacking your bricks. You know, so at a pottery facility, you always have to have a lot of bricks on hand just in case you need them.
Yeah.
So, you know, we stacked them up just the right way, and all of a sudden it became an oven. So it's good for group camaraderie.
Yeah, well, and that's an important component.
We're often out there for, you know, days at a time working and firing kilns, so it's nice to have a little reward in the end.
I used to have an office just down the way from there, and I'd look out there, and it's a week-long party when you fire.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
I had a beginning student yesterday look over and say how easy it looked to fire the wood kiln, and a couple of advanced students, we all looked at each other and were like, okay, sign them up.
Yeah, you're on.
Yep. It's a lot of wood. Usually burn about 2 cords of wood per firing in the summer for our wood firing, but it produces amazing results, you know. Basically, you're heating the kiln up. Hot enough that you're going to melt that ash in the tail end of the firing, about 2,300 degrees.
Mm, wow.
Yeah.
So it does take a lot of wood, and that's a lot of fun to do, too.
It's a big effort, and really teaches the students a lot. It's something you'll never forget.
How many students are actually majoring in fine art?
Between 30 and 50, varying, you know, at times. And I think we have about 500 students total will take classes throughout the year. And, you know, I've got some good luck with some students. I've had one of my students, Bonnie Parker from last year, is in graduate school, and that's a big honor because, you know, it's all expense paid, and she'll be there for 3 years and really get to hone in on what she worked at, you know, here at UAS. And another student, Chelsea Harris, is in Japan working as a teacher over there and getting to really experience Japanese ceramics. I think she's that'll really benefit her work when she comes back. So we've got a new group of students out at school now, which is often just as much fun as anything. So we're starting from scratch, and it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. In addition to firing the kiln and doing the ceramics and teaching at the university and going preparing for your sabbatical and all that sort of stuff, you're also a musician.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. I try to escape reality a little bit every once in a while, hide behind the banjo, I admit.
Yeah. So you got any gigs coming up?
Yeah, we're playing this weekend. There's a large bacon festival downtown at the Jack, and that should be a lot of fun. We're playing there, I think, from 6 to 9.
What's the name of the band?
The Great Alaska Bluegrass Band.
There you go.
And we'll also be playing at the Alaskan Hotel on Friday night and Saturday night from about 10 to 2 in the morning. So get probably about 20 hours in on the banjo this weekend.
So 20 hours on the banjo, 20 hours on the kiln, 20 hours on the banjo. You have a full life.
It gets a little hectic every once in a while.
Yeah, I guess so. Do you ever get overlap and have to, you wouldn't burn the banjo, I guess, right?
Yeah. So sometimes it's probably a good idea.
there's probably about 30 banjo jokes right there all wrapped up in one little action. So what's the first class that someone could register for the summer session?
Well, I would suggest a ceramics course, course, right?
Yeah.
And so we're doing the ceramics class from June 10th to July 5th or something like that. It usually runs about a week extra just to kind of get things together.
How fast do those fill?
They fill quite a bit. I mean, it's a smaller group of students in the summertime, so we usually have about 2 classes instead of 3. But there's 3 classes that are offered, and, you know, it just depends. It seems like there's a lot of good advertising.
So if you're thinking about doing this, you really need to kind of get on it.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea for sure. Yeah. Yep. And also just, you know, scheduling and planning for the summertime because it's intensive course. It's 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the papermaking class, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And that'll be an evening course as well, I think, 4 days a week. And, you know, there's also art appreciation and some online classes that you could potentially take. You know, it just depends on what you want to get interested in. The weaving courses are always really exciting, and, you know, those usually go really well, as well as the Northwest Coast basketry.
Yeah. Hey, I dug through the record of the CD collection here at K2, and we actually can go out with a little bit of your own music.
Hey.
I think you wrote this piece, right? What's the name of it?
I think it's called Semi Bluegrass.
Yeah, Semi Bluegrass. Let's try it. Music was composed and performed by Jeremy Cain and Jeremy Cain's band, the Great Alaskan Bluegrass Band. They're playing a few places around town this weekend, but the big news is that the art classes are starting to register up on the campus for summer arts classes, and if you're interested in some of those, you need to maybe make a move. Check the paper schedule for UAS that came out in Alaska's Capital Weekly, and if you don't want to do it off paper, then go on the website for UAS, and they have the information as well. It's 17 and a half minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest is also a musician and is going to tell us about a program that's going on this weekend at Rockwell. I guess Fire on McGinnis is coming out of the crater here a little bit, huh?
And, of course, Pat, this weekend is St. Patrick's Day,
so we celebrate
all things Celtic. And Fire McGinnis is going to be playing at the Rockwell Saturday night starting at 9 p.m. So go to the Jack first in the evening to Bacon Fest. Get all the bacon and then come on over for some Irish beer and whiskey and soak up all that bacon starting at 9 p.m. And Fire McGinnis will be there to play wonderful Celtic rock stuff. And the whole thing is a fundraiser for the King Island Christmas cast going to Scotland.
Now this is August. Amazing. How many people are involved in the King Island Christmas thing to Scotland?
The King Island Christmas thing, there are close to 40, between 40 and 50 people that are planning to make the trip over to Edinburgh, Scotland.
There's a bunch of kids, too, right?
Bunch of kids. We've got, I think, about 12 or 13 kids, and then the rest are adults. And I'm sure folks have seen King Island Christmas at least once in the past decade since it's come on to the Alaska scene. It's just a wonderful story of an Alaska story set in King Island. In the 1950s, and it was set to music by David Friedman, who was a composer for Aladdin, and Deborah Brevoort, who wrote the libretto and used to be associated with Perseverance Theater. And I just think it's a fantastic story about Alaska, and everyone that's involved is they're really ambassadors for Alaska, and we're taking it to an international stage. The Edinburgh Festival Fringe has upwards of 2,700 different performers that perform in a three-week period in August. And so it's a high-profile arts festival and be a great opportunity for Alaska to show what it does.
This is really a major fundraising activity, then, to get that many people to Edinburgh, Scotland on one
schedule.
It's
to take that many people to Seattle, Washington would be a major fundraising. Yes, it is. The budget's well over $100,000, and we hope by the end of this month that we are close to halfway there. So we've got quite a bit more to do, but everybody that's involved with it is very engaged and working hard. We're doing dinners, and we'll start selling raffle tickets hopefully in the next week or so, and other fundraisers like this party. So it'll be a great way for folks to get involved. Just come out and drink beer at the Rockwell and enjoy St. Patty's Day and give a few bucks to the King Island Christmas cast.
Yeah, I think they're willing to make a $5 donation for each person who pays the cover charge.
Think that's it, yeah. It's a $5 cover.
Yeah. Well, this is a big undertaking to do this. King Island Christmas, I guess the performance could be thought of something as a tribute to Gene Rogers, who died just recently.
That's right.
Yeah. So, she actually wrote the children's book that inspired this story.
Right. So the story is pretty interesting. It's based on King Island Journal, which was written by Ree and Juan Munoz, and it recorded their experiences as social workers on King Island in the early 1950s. And so they published that, or they kept that journal. I'm not sure exactly when they published it. And then Ree shared some of that with Gene, who then turned it into a children's story called King Island Christmas, which Gene wrote and Ree illustrated. And then that was picked up by Deborah Brevoort and David Freeman and turned into a musical. So it's the story has seen a number of different forms over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's opened, I think, originally the first performance was at Perseverance.
I don't know when the first performance was.
I think I remember that was the case. But then it's played practically every Christmas season for years and years. Yeah. They're talking about doing one, I think, sometime this summer as well.
Well, yeah, the show is going to hopefully run in June and or July. And then even sooner than that, if you're really into King Island Christmas, and even if you aren't, we're going to do a King Island Christmas sing-along next month.
Hmm.
And we'll be holding that in the memory of Gene Rogers, who contributed and was a huge supporter of King Island Christmas and the King Island Christmas family.
Yeah, they'll pass out music, so everybody...
Everybody knows the music.
Knows the words, so no one has to... right. Do you know where that's going to be? Do you know where the sing-along is going to be held?
I think it's at the Rockwell, and
okay.
I got a date. I think it is April 27th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, coming up soon.
Coming up soon,
so, yeah. King Island Christmas, that's the benefit for this thing, but the band is the amazing, what do you call yourself, Celtic rock, I guess?
Celtic rock is, we've called ourselves a variety of things. Each member of the band, and I'll tell you about our members in a minute here, but we have probably a spectrum of ideas of what this band is. I sometimes call it Celtic grunge. We've tried to get into the folk festival by calling it Celtic folk rock. That was probably a bit of a stretch.
Bit of a stretch, yeah. But then a lot of the folk festival is a bit of a stretch.
A bit of a stretch, right. Yep. But, yeah, Celtic rock is probably as good a description as any.
Yeah.
We have a wide array of eclectic influences that have influenced our thinking about our music.
Well, what do you say we close this out with a sample of what you're going to be hearing, being able to hear on Friday night, Sunday.
Saturday night,
St.
9 p.m.
Saturday night,
at the Rockwell.
At the Rockwell, good, okay. I think we got that right now. All right, let's go for the music, shall we?
Was down the clan one Easter morning to a city fair rode I, when Ireland's line of marching men in squadrons passed me by. No pipe did hum, no battle drum did self-distress tattoo. The angels fell and the light beat swell rang out in the foggy dew. Right proudly high o'er Dublin town, they flung out a flag of war. 'Twas better to die than I.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's 25 minutes after 3 o'clock. And the music that you've been listening to is going to be heard at the St. Patrick's Day fundraiser. It's Saturday at Rockwell. They're fundraising for King Island Christmas, but they're also celebrating St. Patrick's Day. The party starts at 9 o'clock. It's a $5 cover charge. It goes to the fundraising to take King Island Christmas to Edinburgh, Scotland. So come out and support the group and help us raise money to get them to Scotland. My next two guests are not quite going to Scotland, but they're going to the visitor center out at the glacier tonight to talk about glacier calving. So with me are Roman Matika and Jason Amundsen. They're both with the University of Alaska Southeast, although I think Roman is actually with UAF, or are you?
With both.
Oh, you're both. You're co-locating.
Yeah.
Bi-locating is not quite the same thing. Anyway, so gentlemen, we had a little calving event. Not much of a major flood, but these things can really raise a wave out there, can't they?
Yeah, even through the ice. There was an event that occurred several years ago.
Yes, Roman.
In March. Which generated, it was a sunny day on Sunday, and it was in the afternoon, and there were lots of people on the ice. And the glacier calved, and the wave rolled underneath the ice, and people who were on the ice told me this experience, whoa, you know, this whole...
Like riding on an earthquake.
Yeah, yeah. Right, you almost like surfing on ice, but it certainly caused a lot of excitement.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to predict when these events will happen. This is something we've struggled with as scientists for a long, long time. It seems to almost be a stochastic process. Many things have to come together. We can, in general, say, yes, this glacier is going to calve, but we can't tell you the exact day or exact time it's going to happen. So, yeah, apparently this was an event that happened in the morning, right?
Well, the calving that was most recent, I think, happened about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
It was captured by the cameras, but no one actually was in the visitor center or at the site at the time. So they looked at the footage, and then I think someone up at the university edited a clip of it and put it out on the Internet.
Oh, so. That's probably Matt Hebner,
who used
to be professor here.
Right.
This is something that Jason, my colleague here, has really helped do. This whole thing about time-lapse photography has just changed things, because now you have this eye that's constantly watching what's going on when we can't be there.
So can you describe the system?
Or even when we're there in the field, you can't observe everything at once, but if you have a video of the event, you can go back and look at it more carefully and maybe see things you didn't notice as the event was happening.
So where is it installed? Can you see it?
The camera.
If I go out there, can I look up somewhere?
At Mendenhall, there's one. There's one there on top of the visitor center.
Okay.
That's what Matt Hebner was involved with that Roman was talking about. But also, when we've done field campaigns, we go out and we have a camera taking a photo every 5 or 10 seconds. And a lot of times it's taking photos of nothing. But that way it's running. And so then when a calving event does occur, we record it and have that information.
Now, you came back from Greenland, I think, with an incredible video of an ice field collapsing. I guess that's the only way I could describe it. It was huge.
Yeah, well, it's just the calving events at that particular glacier and at other glaciers in Greenland are just, they're just a different scale than what we have here, that really big glaciers that are flowing really quickly. And so the icebergs that break off can be... Yeah, just huge. It's hard to get a sense of the scale because there's no trees or buildings around. It's just all this ice moving and huge icebergs.
Yeah, the wave size kind of gives away a little bit. Well, there was no water you could really see, but once it had moved about half the way, then there was evidently water behind it because I saw a big wave splash come up.
Definitely. It produces waves that are, you know, several feet high.
Yeah, this is accessible on your website. So if you go to your personal website, that film clip is...
Yeah, and I think I'll be talking about that same one tonight as well.
Yeah.
But we have other similar ones from different calving
events. Were you there when that happened? Just standing there and
just
all of a sudden, whammo.
And laughing and thinking that this can't be real. But, you know, if you saw that in a Hollywood movie, you would think it was... Just
yeah, somebody faked it, right? Yeah, you'd be looking around for the spinning attachment in the washing machine where they photographed the thing, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, these calving events are so large and generate so much energy, they actually generate earthquakes that can be recorded at a considerable distance away from the actual event. Mm. That generated a whole area of study, which Jason helped pioneer, is glacial earthquakes. These could be, what, magnitude 3 or 4 earthquakes?
Or even almost magnitude 5.
Wow. Yeah.
So a lot of energy being generated.
Yeah. Trying to remember, what was the one that the earthquake that we just had offshore?
That was a magnitude 7 point something.
7.8.
That's quite a bit bigger.
If I remember right. Yeah. So a 5, but that's not a linear scale.
No, it isn't. Right. It's order of magnitude for each number.
Yeah. Right. So two orders of magnitude less off of a glacier.
Right.
Still, that's spectacular. That'll knock a shelf loose somewhere nearby. Anyway, do we have, how much wiring is there on Mendenhall? I know the department has been kind of putting out sensors and all sorts of things. There's a whole bunch of research that's done on Mendenhall.
Well, just to tail back to the time-lapse cameras, in addition to the mats on top of the visitor center, the Extreme Ice Survey has one out there, and UAS still has another one out there. If you walk out towards the Nugget Falls, there's that big rock peninsula that juts into the lake where the glacier used to be. That's where a lot of the instruments are located. The time-lapse camera, they have a weather station there. But more recently, Jason's been involved with instrumenting and monitoring Suicide Basin. That's where these big outburst floods have been generated from.
With the impossible to pronounce name.
Yokolop.
Good. So we're hoping to get a pressure sensor up there and maybe a camera just to look at Suicide Basin. But you know, that's one of the nice things about working at Mendenhall is that it's accessible and we're able to put out and maintain instruments over long time periods.
I'm always intrigued. I think we may be the only city in the world that's got a glacier in its city limits.
Just flowing right into our backyard.
Yeah.
it's great for monitoring purposes. We've periodically have put sensors into the lake to monitor water temperature and then sensors right on the glacier. And part of the work we've done on that glacier and many other glaciers is look at the ice thickness with a radar system. So we know how thick the ice is. And one of the reasons that's calving right now is Kathy Connor, another professor out at the university. She continued work on looking at the depth of the lake, and it's 90 meters deep. That's about 300 feet deep, right in the center of the face over there. So that's quite deep, and so the glacier actually comes to flotation and breaks off in these calving events.
Hmm.
And that's something we see more often in tidewater glaciers. The tidewater glaciers, which mostly we're going to talk about this evening, activity is commonly... it's much more active. The frequency of calving events is almost daily, if not hourly. Mm-hmm. And then big calving events like the one that Jason recorded that you mentioned happens on the order of 7 to 10 days. You kind of get a feel for when it's going to happen. So you just wait around and, there it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Alaska, a lot of my work has been on LeConte Glacier, which is next to Petersburg over there. Their events are a little more often the McBait major events. They happen maybe every 3 to 4 days. But while you're there all the time, there's stuff coming off into the water, so they're quite spectacular. You don't want to get too close. Right?
Stay off the ice.
Yeah.
How'd you get interested in this?
How did I get into it? I originally was trained as a physicist and worked in a lab, and long story short, I really liked the outdoors, and I was a climber at that time and was climbing on glaciers, and I decided, maybe I can put this together and make a living at it. And I just found them to be very fascinating. And then two, three, 4 decades ago, I really got interested in tidewater glaciers from kayaking. I said, this is pretty spectacular. And then much more recently, what's driving it is the whole concern about sea level rise, right? And if you look at the literature, and a lot of it we contributed to, the literature, fully 50% or more of the ice loss here in Alaska and the ice loss in Greenland is due to these kinds of glaciers, calving glacier systems. And almost all of Antarctica is due to calving ice loss there. So that's what's been driving it now. It's just been quite important socially and publicly. People got to know what's happening, how much sea level is going to rise through the next decades or so they can take whatever action they need to do
So there's evidence that the calving rate is increasing because of the increased water temperature?
Part of that is what we think is happening in Greenland. Part of that may have happened here in Alaska. There's evidence that indicates, this is something that we'll talk about tonight, is it looks like warmer water migrated up coast along the west coast of Greenland and helped destabilize this particular glacier we'll talk about. So Alaska contributes quite a bit to sea level rise, and Greenland is now too, because these same kinds of glaciers we had here in Alaska, the tidewater glaciers, are now becoming unstable in Greenland. And when they go unstable, it's catastrophic. They just go. You know, just recently, South Sawyer capped back 2 kilometers or over a mile. Good examples what happened in Glacier Bay. Have you been to Glacier Bay?
No, I haven't.
Oh, yeah, perhaps.
I got to eventually.
250 years ago, ice exited out into Icy Straits, the Lammerseer Island. And over a period of about 150 years, it calved back about 120 kilometers, or about 72 miles, almost a kilometer per year. And that was all driven by calving. Climate maybe started the whole thing, but once that calving starts, it just takes over. It's independent of climate. It's driven by the dynamics of the being in a deep fjord. So we find it fascinating, but still a bit chilling. Not to make a pun, but
warming, I guess, rather than
warming.
Chilling. Anyway.
Yeah, and if you look at, for example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, there's a consortium of scientists that make these reports every several years, and there's discussion in there about how much sea level is going to rise in the next 100 years, and there's a lot of uncertainty with that, and a lot of that uncertainty comes from the fact that we don't understand calving, that there's we just don't know how the glaciers are going to evolve going forward in time.
How does our glacier research fit into the world of science? I mean, are you both known among people who are trying to put this together?
Well, I know Jason. just the field has grown tremendously because of this concern with sea level rise and with the destabilization of both Greenland and now Antarctica. So I suppose on a worldwide basis, yes, we're known within our field quite well.
So people would recognize Mendenhall Glacier as a place where research is done and like that, and Juneau, Alaska as a source of research?
Not so much Mendenhall, because there's only been a few studies done there,
okay,
but definitely like Roman was mentioning, LeConte Glacier,
yeah.
Or work that's been done on Columbia or Hubbard.
Or Glacier Bay.
Glacier Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or over in Greenland now. So part of what's happened is the work we've done here on tidewater glaciers in Alaska, we're trying to translate that information, that body of experience, to what's going on in Greenland now. In the past 6, 7, 8 years, that's where our focus has been, is on Greenland more than Alaska. But still, Alaska is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We just did a study last past summer at LeConte Glacier. We went back there, and we'll show videos from there. What's nice about LeConte is it's very focused. It's small, and it's bite-sized. We can kind of have better control on what all the factors and parameters are. When you look at this big glacier that Jason will show this evening, it's a lot harder. It's just because of the enormity of the size of it.
Yeah.
So we try to scale up. You know, what's going on at LeConte Glacier or Mendenhall? Can we scale that up to what might be happening in Greenland?
To what extent is there? We just had an interdisciplinary conference here in Juneau on sea otters. And I'm wondering,
on sea ice?
On sea ice,
okay.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, do those kinds of things happen regularly? Are we bringing other disciplines into these scientific questions and combining?
So I would say that even like, definitely 15 years ago, glaciology was a lot more isolated in a way,
mm-hmm.
that there's been a lot more people coming in from oceanography that are interested in how does the ocean affect the glacier, and also how do the glaciers affect the ocean. Roman mentioned the earthquakes that are being generated by calving icebergs, and that's bringing in seismologists.
Yep.
It's definitely the field is changing a lot.
And we just had that workshop last week that tried to address this. So we have the glaciers feeding a fjord system and the ocean, and that workshop basically tried to bring together. This is the one that Aaron and Shad talked about,
yeah.
And gave a talk last week. involving biologists and managers and oceanographers and chemists. So, yeah, it's gotten to be a lot more interdisciplinary, and I think that's the direction that we're going in, just trying to get all these people together, talking to each other, and trying
to understand. Well, I understand that was like a local conference with a couple of guests from outside, but I'm wondering if worldwide this kind of...
We're going to have one in June, actually back in the East Coast, that's going to bring together people from all over the world in one spot to look at just glacier-ocean interactions, because it's gotten so important in Greenland. There's a conference just being devoted to that. So, yeah, it does happen in much more frequency.
It seems to me that that's part of the key here to understanding something as difficult to get your hands around as climate change, because it's such a huge modeling problem.
Climate change and ocean change.
Yeah.
So it gets very complicated.
Yeah, all related. But I think you can say that, I mean, just looking back historically, how Earth science has evolved over the last 40 or 50 years, that there's been a movement to treat the Earth more as a big system, and there's all these different components that interact with each other, and you can't think about one system without thinking about the systems that it interacts with.
Well, we have a wonderful opportunity tonight at 6:30 and 8 p.m. The program is the same. It repeats. You do it once at 6:30 and then again at 8 o'clock. And this is the regular Fireside Lecture Series at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Roman Motika and Jason Amundsen will be out there to share some of their experiences looking at glacial calving. Thank you, gentlemen, for doing the show, and thanks for being on my show. I really appreciate your coming on and telling folks that this is coming up.
Well, thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 15th of March, 2013. The 15th of March, the Ides of March, in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar the Soothsayer, said, "Beware the Ides of March." It was on this day in 44 B.C. that Caesar was assassinated by a group of about 60 conspirators. They called themselves the Liberators. One of the leaders was Marcus Brutus, whose mother had been one of Caesar's lovers and whom Caesar helped to establish in government. It's the birthday of the novelist Ben Okri, born in Minna, Nigeria, 1959, author most recently of Starbook and Tales of Freedom. 1956, on this day, the musical My Fair Lady opened on Broadway, starring Julie Andrews and Rex Harrison, based on the play Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw, who had died in 1950, and so he was powerless to prevent Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe from changing his story. George Bernard Shaw was sure that Eliza would have married the young man, Freddie, and not Henry Higgins, but the musical leaves you believing that she would go with Henry Higgins, that is. It's the birthday of the biographer Richard Ellman, born in Highland Park, Michigan, 1918, went to Yale, studied literature, started to write his dissertation on William Butler Yeats, and then World War II broke out. He enlisted. He was stationed in London. He took a leave to go visit Dublin. He met the widow of Yeats, Georgie Yeats, and she told him all sorts of stories about her late husband and opened up his study, his bookcase, all his manuscripts, his letters, his journals, which led to Ellman's biography, Yeats, The Man and the Masks. It came out in 1948. 11 years later, he published his biography, James Joyce, which won the National Book Award. Anthony Burgess called it the greatest literary biography of the century. And just before Richard Ellman died, he finished his last great biography, Oscar Wilde, in which he wrote, "Of all writers, Wilde was perhaps the best company. Always endangered, he laughs at his plight, and on his way to the loss of everything, jollies society for being so much harsher than he is, so much less graceful, so much less attractive." Here's a poem for today by Naomi Shihab Nye, entitled Prayer in My Boot. For the wind no one expected, for the boy who does not know the answer, for the graceful handle I found in a field attached to nothing, pray it is universally applicable. For our tracks which disappear the moment we leave them, for the face peering through the cafe window as we sip our soup, for cheerful American classrooms sparkling with crisp colored alphabets, happy cat posters, the cage of the guinea pig, the dog with division flying out of his tail, and the classrooms of our cousins on the other side of the earth. How solemn they are, how gray or green or plain, how there is nothing dangling, nothing striped or polka-dotted or cheery, no self-portraits or visions of Cupids. And in these rooms, the students raise their hands and learn the stories of the world. For library books in alphabetical order, and family businesses that failed, and the house with the boarded windows, and the gap in the middle of a sentence, and the envelope we keep mailing ourselves, for every hopeful morning given and given, and every future rough edge, and every afternoon turning over in its sleep. A poem, Prayer in My Boot, by Naomi Shihab Nye, from 19 Varieties of Gazelle, Poems for the Middle East, published by HarperCollins and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to, thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 13 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is here to tell us about a sea voyage. David Leggett is going to take his boat, I believe she's called the Swifter, from Juneau down to Sitka and then out of Sitka on a number of runs this summer through mid-May through mid-July. And what David is doing actually is going to be collecting big bags of plastic garbage and trying to create some awareness of the problem of plastic in our oceans. Hi, David.
Hi.
So tell us about Coastal Footprint.
Coastal Footprint is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to further scientific knowledge concerning the transport of plastic debris in oceanic waters, prevent plastic from reaching the ocean, and remove anthropogenic debris from coastal areas.
Anthropogenic.
Human-created.
Human-created. Okay, good. All right.
We were started in 2010 by UAS alumni, and that summer they completed a voyage from here to Panama, 205 days at sea. They collected 22,500 pounds of garbage off of the beaches along the way. They
so over 10 tons.
Yeah.
Of plastic, of garbage.
Yep, yeah.
Okay.
And they would, you know, go out to remote beaches and also in communities and conduct beach cleanups and have it dealt with at the local facilities. They boarded 33 volunteers, most of them not sailors, you know, good experience to learn how to sail. And then for the last couple of years, we've kind of been under the radar, not much going on. And this past fall, I decided to take over and see if I could make a go at it and make something happen with this organization.
I love your logo. You can see it on their website. It's go to the Coastal Footprint, but it's a skull, and beneath it is a plastic bottle, and the bottom of a looks like a extra tough boot.
Yeah, it was designed by a good friend of ours, Nicola Trainer.
Outstanding. It looks like the Jolly Roger, but it's the Jolly Roger with a smile.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So, can you, if somebody wants to run out on the Swifter with you and help pick up plastic trash, or pick up trash this summer, anthropomorphic trash, how would they volunteer? How would they let you know?
You just start off by getting in touch with me. You can email me at info@coastalfootprint.org.
Okay.
And, we can start talking about dates you're available and what the trips consist of and sort of what it's going to be all about. You know, their trips are going to run about 2 weeks each trip. We ask you to be available for a couple of days on either end of that just because we don't know. It's obviously hard to dictate the weather. So we may get stuck in an anchorage for a couple of days and have to wait. And we're working right now on helping students to be able to earn credit while they volunteer with us.
Hmm.
And basically the way it's going to run is that we'll have between three or four crew on board, and we'll run in shifts when we're sailing. We'll each, you know, depending on how many crew there are on board, your shifts will vary in length, and we'll leave from Sitka after filling our fuel tanks and our water tanks and purchasing food and stowing gear and giving everyone a solid orientation on the boat and where everything is and safety procedures and how to work different lines and how to anchor and all this kind of stuff. This will all be gone over, and then we'll set sail. And then depending on how far our target location is for that trip, could take us, you know, no more than a long day or maybe 2 days to get there. And this may include night shifts and sailing through the night. And then we'll basically get where we're going, drop an anchor, start conducting our beach cleanups and our debris research. We're working with NOAA to help them catalog concentrations and types of debris on different beaches. And we'll either stay in that anchorage for the whole 2 weeks if there's enough work, or we'll be hopping around in that general area. And then once either the boat is full or, you know, there's a weather window, we'll be headed back to Sitka to unload and take care of any maintenance work and resupply, and then head on another mission.
What kinds of things do you expect you'll find?
I'm expecting to find quite a bit of derelict fishing gear. I've seen a lot of that out there on the outer coast. Things like fishing nets and buoys and big chunks of styrofoam. There's a lot of that out there. I'm really curious to see how much debris is we can suspect comes from the Japanese tsunami.
Yeah. Taking a Geiger counter?
Nothing to worry about there. All that was released before the plant had the meltdown there, so nothing to worry about there. You know, it's hard to tell what came from the tsunami and what would just be there, is what I've heard.
Well, unless you get a soccer ball with somebody's name.
Right, yeah. There's obviously going to be some stuff that's, you know, not from our shores. Stuff like that. A lot of plastic water bottles and things that just get caught up in the currents coming from down south or from Hawaii or from other parts of the world.
I remember reading that fish are particularly, that the biggest problem is not so much the large junk, but the fact that the ocean currents break the plastic up into such small pieces that it's actually consumed with food or fed or eaten by mistake by fish. And
So as plastic exists out there in the marine environment, it is photodegrades. The sunlight actually acts upon it and breaks up the hydrogen-carbon bonds. And then wave action will, you know, further that process into smaller and smaller pieces. And a lot of times it resembles small organisms that creatures are eating. And they eat it, and this can cause a number of issues. Obviously, chemicals in the plastics are very harmful for them. But also, since the fish or birds or sea mammals are not digesting these plastic particles, they actually stay in their stomach and cause the animal to feel full. So this can lead to malnourishment and even starvation because they're not actively searching out food. In a lot of waters, the concentration of microplastic debris is very similar to the concentration of small zooplankton and the you know, baseline foods. So it's got a lot of, you know, it goes just beyond the entanglement issues and, you know, which are present and are obvious. But yeah, them consuming it. And there's pictures out online and stuff of seabirds and sea turtles that actually have full-on, like, cigarette lighters inside of their stomachs and you know, larger pieces of debris.
So. You're obviously, with a crew of, like, 5-6 people on a sailboat going out to some remote place, you're obviously not going to make a major impact. I mean, there's no way you could get all of the plastic out of the sea. So how do you go on then to get somebody to notice that this is a big problem?
I think that this year's mission is the biggest, most important aspect of it is the research and figuring out what's there and sort of doing a really close inspection of what's there and where it is. I would also, you're right, we can't fit very much stuff on a 30-foot boat. That's just the bottom line. I'm working on creating relationships with fishermen out there and companies like Allen Marine to where when our boat's full, if we spot one of their boats, we could raft up next to them and unload to them. And we have the city of Sitka, Docks and Harbors, is actually going to take care of all of the debris we bring back and accept it into their dumpsters. And so some sort of relationship there where we could stay out longer and send what we've collected back with other you know, other boats back to Sitka to have it dealt with there. That's sort of the direction I'm hoping to go. And then, obviously, a 60-foot schooner with major trash holes would be really cool.
Yeah. So if anyone has a 60-foot schooner that they're not using, contact David Leggett.
Tax deductible.
Yeah. Well, you are a 401c3. Anyway, are there? There's this big Pacific gyre that we know about.
Yes.
I think that's the way you pronounce it.
Gyre.
Gyre. Okay.
Yes.
Anyway, are there other ocean current caused gyres?
Do
we have any around us?
Well, the North Pacific is the closest gyre to us.
Okay.
And then there's the South Pacific gyre, and most large ocean basins have their own gyre, and all of those are collection points for plastic debris.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that you'll ever try to do something like collect in there?
The problem with collecting in the ocean gyres is that the debris is so small and it's spread out over such a large area, it's almost an impossibility. It would require so much time and effort. A lot of organizations that are out there working and doing research in those areas, I think that their main focus is not to try to collect, but to research and figure out where it's all coming from and stem the flow before it reaches the ocean,
right,
which is also a part of our mission statement, is to keep those, you know, keep debris from reaching the ocean, which is, you know, would involve the communities near the coast and on major rivers taking care of their trash and, you know, keeping it contained and not allowing it to reach the ocean.
Yeah, it seems like the ocean seems so large that you couldn't hurt it by throwing a little plastic in it.
Right.
And that's exactly where the problem begins, right?
That's exactly where the problem begins, yeah.
Toss the can overboard and, oh, dear.
Right. It'll sink and go away and
you'll never see it again. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I admire your undertaking. It sounds like a fascinating way for somebody to spend, 14 days plus two on each end, about 18 days down in sailing adventurously out of Sitka and picking up trash on a beach someplace and then sailing back to Sitka after a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm going to have a great adventure.
I think so, too. So it's David Leggett. The website, again, is...
CoastalFootprint.org.
CoastalFootprint.org. And if you're interested, you can email.
info@coastalfootprint.org.
info@coastalfootprint.org. And if you want to volunteer, please do.
Get in touch soon. We've got some crew that are signing up and people are interested. And so, you know, sign up soon.
Okay. David Leggett, captain of the Swifter, thank you so much for telling us about your plans for the summer.
Thank you.
Me, Katie B., for the next KRNN Showcase, Americana, from Nashville to Alaska, with Harrison B. and C. Scott Fry, Wednesday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at the Goldtown Theater. Advance tickets $10 at KRNN.org and the station, or $12 at the door. The Musical Journey, looking forward and looking back. Live music and conversation with Harrison B. and C. Scott Fry.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We're also on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek hears us on K269 AO at 101.7. And Gustavus, we're on 88.1 MHz. K201 AM is the call sign. K220 BT serves Hoona at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9. I'll be hosting the show on Monday. I'll look forward to seeing you then. We're going to talk with Kim Kiefer, the city manager, about CBJ activities. Tom Putman, producer of Burn, will be showing this week at Goldtown Theater. We'll also hear from Ryan Canaro and Sarah Canaro with the Generator Theater Company. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.